This is a scene from season 2 of House of Cards. The First Lady, played by Robin Wright, is home alone with the bodyguard. The president, Kevin Spacey, finds them having drinks and gets home late.
Looks like I almost missed the party.
I'm off the clock, sir.
Oh, relax. Francis, I broke a glass and Edward cut his hand on a piece of it.
The president sees his bodyguard's bandage.
Jesus.
Oh, wow, I need to change that. Take that off and I'll get fresh.
Ruh-roh, what's going on?
I hope you don't mind, sir. I was off duty.
Is she, drunk?
A little.
How many of these you had?
A few.
More than a few. May I?
Please.
And so begins a really memorable seduction scene. It got that bodyguard character played by Kansas City-born actor Nathan Darrow a lot of attention. Now Nathan's getting ready for his next gig as Hamlet in the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival here in town starting tonight. He's here in the studio with me now. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And Nathan Darrow, good morning.
Hi, Gina. It's good to be here.
Is it weird to hear that scene sitting here like in Kansas City in a radio studio?
Well, it's weird just to hear the audio. I've never experienced that without the image. So, it's interesting.
And your role in that show, there was a pretty strong visual component just because you are frequently like your original role. You started as the driver and then Meacham gets promoted kind of. So you're often like Kevin Spacey's talking to the camera and you're looking really serious with sunglasses on driving the presidential car.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, this was a revelation of some of who he was, for sure. That wasn't necessarily seen yet so directly. Yeah.
So it's a pretty interesting next step to come back to Kansas City and be in a Shakespeare performance here outdoors at South Moreland Park. Talk to me about going from being in a just giant Netflix series with Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright to being back in your hometown doing Shakespeare.
Interesting. How do you mean interesting?
Well, I guess, I don't know. It's not going to be talked about all over the blogosphere, this next gig.
Well, I like this question because it allows me to maybe give a little speech.
Please.
The first line of the speech is that I sort of am unfond of the question because maybe I'm a little sensitive, but I can't help but hear a little like a little bust on my hometown in it, you know, because I figure why not Kansas City? You know, what I've experienced in my career and in my life as an actor and trying to make work and trying to make theater is that it is always difficult and it is always worthy. And that doesn't change with your location.
Yeah, doing good work isn't more important in one place than in another.
Correct. And also... you know, being maybe in New York or being somewhere that somebody might consider a more fabulous place is, again, just a place. And it has as much absurdity and narrow-mindedness as it has talent and, you know, things about it that are interesting. Coming to Kansas City is just as interesting and, again, difficult to make the work as it is anywhere else.
I love that answer. You know, it's, I guess just in the world of professional arts, having the sort of, I don't know, the accolades that people recognize as sort of like that's a notch on your resume.
Yes.
That's a big deal.
Yes.
And so it's, I think, unusual for someone to step away from that for a moment. Not that playing Hamlet is a big deal. I mean,
yes,
playing that lead
role. Of course it is. But that leads me to another part of this question that the other part of the question that I'm inspired to talk about the actual life of a working actor, which I dare say I think a lot of people don't understand properly, probably because, you know, the media tends to say, well, you're either struggling or you've made it, and that a career always has this, you know, 45 degree angle up, or it should. And, you know, in reality, in my situation at present, this was the next best job for me. And this is the life that we live. You know, there's actors that struggle for 10, 15 years to barely make their health insurance. And then all of a sudden, maybe they get on a show and they're making, you know, $250,000 a year for 3 years. And then after that, you know what happens? They're back to the same thing. They're back to the struggling. There is not this myth of making it is really not.
Like, it, you did it, now you're done.
No, it's really not. And honestly, I know this even from being around people who we would definitely say have made it, and not only made it, have been extremely successful. Like, they don't operate in that way. They're always looking for, well, what's the next thing that's going to feed me as an artist? And obviously, you know, that's going to help me as a professional, because definitely I'm putting the bread on the table with this. So I'm not saying that those considerations don't come into play. They definitely do. But what I'm saying is that the trajectory is usually much more complicated and varied than we're given the impression through, I don't know what you would say, magazines, television, the way we think of the life of an actor being.
No, and I appreciate that. Yeah. Also, just my perception is that sometimes success on paper doesn't always translate to a comfortable life necessarily.
Well, sure. Absolutely. You know, the difficulty of, you know, living with yourself in this world that is absurd and uncertain, you know, money, success does not insulate you from having to meet the challenge of that.
It sounds like this is something, though, that maybe you have wrestled with just in your experience being really catapulted to a very prominent place to the public very quickly, though I'm sure that for you, that's not how you experienced it.
Okay. So, I mean, I was not blind to the fact that House of Cards was a, you know, a huge thing, and not just for me, but for a lot of people, and that a lot of people saw it. I think along with it, always, just like in maybe in any job, I was always kind of, you know, wondering, is this, am I bringing all of myself to it properly? Is it vital? Is it of value? You know, all that kind of thing. But you're always asking yourself that, I think.
Oh my God, you sound so much like Hamlet though right now.
Right.
So can we talk about that character? You're
Please,
playing
yeah,
Hamlet
yeah.
in the Shakespeare Festival's production here in town. And that character, internal wrestling and turmoil are such hallmarks of who he is and what he brings to this story. Can you mm-hmm. talk about that character and maybe what inspired you to feel like this was a great next role?
Well, sure. I mean, what we see of Hamlet. Now, mind you, there's a whole Hamlet before the play starts that if you listen carefully to the play, you will get little glimpses of. And it's very, very interesting because it's a different person than we see. But the Hamlet that we see through the five acts of Shakespeare's play is, as you say, a person who is in a inner conflict. His line of action, his real line of action, is inside of him. And I would say that as a person, I relate to that in that, you know, whenever you sort of stop and think for a second, what is this thing we're living in? What is it? What am I looking at?
Are you talking about life?
Yeah, I'm talking about life.
Yeah. This thing.
This thing, yes, means life. You know, but to...
Hey, Matthew?
I guess to really look at it consciously and carefully and with vulnerability, it takes a lot of, I would say, courage to do that. Now, some people are just compelled. Hamlet maybe seems compelled, but also, you know, he doesn't necessarily have to. But when we start to look, we start to have to say, is it beautiful? Is it absurd? Is it meaningless? And then this all starts to become synthesized, and in the play, I feel like it's synthesized in a very mysterious and beautiful way. Hamlet has a line in the second scene of the play. He says, "I have that within which passes show." And
what does that mean?
Well, he is talking specifically at the moment to his mother about probably about what he is going through in the wake of the death of his father, and the grief and the confusion and I guess the crisis that he can't move beyond. But
his father, the King of Denmark.
That's right. His father, the King of Denmark, has died suddenly, and after a very, very brief period of mourning, his mother has married that man's brother, his Hamlet's own uncle. So she has sort of left the mourning term. Hamlet remains in the mourning term as the play begins, and he can't get out of it, try as he might. But I don't know. Regarding that line, I think it begins to have to do with this big question of, like, what is inside of me? What is inside us? What is a person? A need to make contact with that, a recognition that we can lose contact with that.
Tell me about the Hamlet before the five acts of five acts.
Okay.
Of Shakespeare's,
yeah, sure.
Play. You just mentioned, sure, that there's a whole other Hamlet, yeah. And I think I get what you mean, but maybe for explaining, okay, it for people,
yeah,
even who haven't necessarily read the
play. No, I'd love to do that. I mean, and even people who have read the play and studied the play, I think tend to extrapolate maybe a different Hamlet, and that's totally fine. But oftentimes we think, oh, well, he's in his head, he's a student, he's sort of simply privileged, and just always thinking and wondering. I think there's evidence in the script that actually the Hamlet before the play is a very active person. He knows that he will be king of this country, and to that end, he wants to do it properly. He wants to serve his people well. So I believe that he has, in fact, practically studied things like agriculture. He's studied trade, business. He's obviously studied law, religion. He has a connection with people, with the people of his country. So he has not just, like, stayed in the palace. He's traveled, he's learned languages. And I think that all of this serves a dual purpose. It serves his interest. He's interested in the world, but also he wants to be a good king, and he wants to actually move his country forward so that the lives of the people in it are better. And so he's preparing vigorously to take on this position. And then when his father dies, that is also pulled from him, because his uncle, in marrying his mother, seizes the monarchy, takes the crown. And so he is left not just with his grief, but with his grief and with nothing to apply all of this to, everything that he's worked on to.
Yeah, like all the momentum behind all of that, where does it go?
Right. So the main takeaway, I think, is that we think of Hamlet as a person who is unable to act. I don't know that this is his nature. I think that this is what we see in the play, and it's very interesting, and it's especially interesting for somebody who is extremely capable of being active and organized and engaged in life. But of course, death is something that when it hits, it changes it all.
Well, so how do you think that your personal interpretation of Hamlet and what's just happened to him and how it's really changed him a lot, at least temporarily, you know, how does that affect the way you play this character? Do you think it is different from how other actors have interpreted?
Oh, I'm not really sure because I don't necessarily know what goes into other actors when they come to play Hamlet. I mean, I have seen many Hamlets, and 95% of them are absolutely brilliant, and I would not ever think to know what that actor was thinking about when they started. I just have to kind of go with what I have, right? Does that get to the question?
But is there a moment that you think Hamlet's previously very active, very capable and sure-footed approach, do you think that there is a moment in this play where what you choose to do with the character of Hamlet, who's so torn and indecisive and kind of paralyzed by his grief and doubt and really his feeling of betrayal, do you think that there is a moment that you perform in a particular way because you're thinking of this guy as a previously capable, strong guy with direction?
I do understand. I don't know that there's a particular moment. I think that it's somewhat in the language that he's given by Shakespeare, that even sometimes in these moments, there's a very, very interesting moment when they're waiting to try to see the ghost that now has been appearing, you know, and now Hamlet's going out to maybe see this figure to get some, you know, to get some knowledge how to proceed. And he starts talking about politics. He starts talking about this ritual that they have in Denmark that he is opposed to because of how it makes them seen in the world. And it's interesting because Hamlet is still in this spot where emotionally he's not sure how to proceed. And I think he's very, you know, he's bound up, but this still is coming out. It still is there. So it's almost like it's something that starts to peek out from behind, if that makes sense.
Nathan Darrow, thank you so much for visiting with us today.
Thank you.
Nathan will be playing Hamlet in the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival in Southmoreland Park starting tonight. Up next, Juneteenth in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Now let's talk about Juneteenth in Kansas City. When slavery ended in the United States, it took some time for word to travel to slaves in Texas who found out they were free a really long time after the Emancipation Proclamation had actually been signed. Juneteenth is a celebration commemorating that moment of discovering freedom. Kansas City's had a Juneteenth celebration since 1980. It was started by a man named Horace Peterson, and this year it's expected to be bigger thanks to his family. I'd like to welcome Makita Peterson, Horace's daughter, to the show. Hi, Makita.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Tell me about the significance of Juneteenth from your perspective.
Well, from my personal, I guess on my end, it's more of definitely a sense of community and family that I remembered growing up as a child, because when my father brought the celebrations in the early 80s, I wasn't even born at that point. So by 1985, I was brought in, and then the celebrations had really grown and had really began to flourish. And it's just the sense of community that I remember, the feeling of walking in the 18th and Vine District and smelling the barbecue, seeing animals, just seeing everyone interacting, and that sense of family and also pride of being an African American.
You know, it means something for a city to have a Juneteenth celebration. Not all cities do. And I wonder what you think the significance of Kansas City even having its own Juneteenth celebration is.
I think it's huge. We have such a rich history of our story, from slavery up even through the civil rights era. I mean, even how our city in essence really manufactured, with the troops being the dividing line of socioeconomic status in Kansas City, with blockbusting, and I mean, even if we acknowledge the fact that Westport, you know, really was a trading site for slaves back during slavery, you know, to understand that, and then where Kansas City now and how it became a rich state or city of African-American culture as well, with jazz and during that Renaissance era. I mean, you really see the progression of us from, you know, from being a people of struggle to being now a people that are thriving and that are, you know, have talents and can do much more than just be, you know, simple slaves.
This is such a complicated holiday. Even listening to you describe it, there's the celebratory aspect, and then there's remembering really heavy, heavy stuff, mm-hmm. not just slavery. That's heavy enough on its own, of course, but like all these different moments in even our local history, the idea of racial dividing lines and where they come from, and that this is a part of why it's important for Kansas City to have this holiday. How do you merge the celebrating and the remembering and teaching and acknowledging?
I guess it's more of a celebration and more of a reminder and a motivator of why we're doing what we're doing, why it's important to be free, where we came from and where we're going and what we can be. And it really to understanding the celebration of our independence and celebrating in the 18th in my district is why it's so important, because that district became at one point our hub of our community. I mean, we at one point we weren't allowed to go onto the plaza to shop. We weren't allowed to go into certain areas. So we turned 18th and Vine District into our shopping areas, where you can go to the drugstore, you can have your restaurants, you know, your clubs. Everything was centralized in that area. And we celebrate that even now, that we can build on our own, we can thrive. And now we even open it up to the entire community, the entire world, to celebrate with us and to share our culture with us.
We've mentioned that your dad started Juneteenth here in Kansas City. He was a big deal here in town. He also started the Black Archives of Mid-America. And I'm curious, from just your memories of him, what's your sense of what drove him to work so hard to bring Black history to life in Kansas City through Juneteenth celebrations and other things?
I just think he had a genuine love for his culture, his people. I think he had a genuine love for what we can produce, and he wanted to share it, and he would find things. He was a collector. I really believe my dad, in essence, too, was a hoarder, and he just would see these things and would not want to see them just get thrown away. Like, there were elders in the community that were, you know, passing on things or were getting rid of things that were really are instrumental in our history, with him even going to get Aunt Lucy's cabin, which is part in Black Archives of Mid-America. I remember as a child playing in a cabin, and that speaks volumes, that I played in a slave cabin in this institution. I played with the slave dolls and interacted with them, and not having a real understanding of the story at that time. But
can you tell us the story of that cabin?
I don't know. I believe it came from the South in Arkansas. I believe it's Aunt Lucy's cabin. I know she's lived in it for quite some time. From what I remember, Dad had found it. It was dilapidated by that point, but he actually transported it from that plantation back to Kansas City so that it could be rebuilt in the archives. I don't know the true story about Aunt Lucy, unfortunately, but that's the story I know of the cabin.
But what's cool about that, I mean, really telling about that, is that your experience of these things that your dad worked on and studied was so personal. It wasn't about, you know, memorizing facts.
Right.
You have this really visceral memory.
Yeah, it was part of our life. Like, we grew up, and there's one piece that was in the archives and it's still there now that's really, I mean, speaks volumes. It's a KKK uniform, the whole garb, you know, and everything. And I saw that as a kid walking through the archives and things. But a past that you see the things that are of progression. You see the pictures and the mementos and things that, and even having those, that garb and an actual charter from the KKK, and we have that in the museum, you know, speaks volumes to the fact that, you know, we don't want to hide from that history either. We want to embrace it. We understand it. And to even look at that level of sometimes that hate, it's, you know, it can change your motivation of what you are going to do or what you want to do in life.
Your dad studied African American history and Missouri folklore, and other than just these encounters that you would have Did that seep into how he raised you?
Oh, I think definitely. I mean, we grew up, my mom as well. We're very much academics. My mom was an attorney, or is an attorney. She's not. She still is an attorney for the Environmental Protection Agency, but also was a journalist for the New York Times during her time as well. So both of them grew up very much, being the first African-Americans in their trade. And Dad went to the Smithsonian as well during his period. So my life was really more, I guess, we were exposed to a lot. And even in Kansas City, and that's why I think I'm motivated to Juneteenth, is because growing up as a child, we had, access to activities. And the museums were a little bit more open to, really being part of the neighborhood that we were invited in, that it really enriched my life and exposed me to a well-rounded perspective on community and what our history is.
Tell me more about those celebrations that you remember as a small child.
It was, I was so small because back then it was from basically, by five, my father had passed away. So it really, I just remember though, just the sense of being on the street. I remember the smells. I really just remember the feeling, I would say. It's that really, and we felt that feeling at the parade last weekend. It's that sense of just that positive vibe, everyone's smiling, saying hello, greeting each other. Kids are in the street just running around, just everyone just enjoying, being in Kansas City summer heat, but still enjoying what we're there for, and that's to celebrate each other.
So the parade is an interesting thing. There, if I understand this right, there used to be a parade, and then for the last 20 years or so, there hasn't been one, and you have revived the parade.
Yeah. It was definitely, this is the first year we've done the parade. It was a lot of work. We had a committee that was very dedicated because I could not. The festival itself is, it takes a lot of energy and a lot of time out of myself personally. But the community itself said, we want to see this, and really it was quite funny. And I brought it up to some other people. You would see the response on Facebook after the St. Patrick's Day parade. And you would really see it from the community, like, well, why don't we do our own? And I'm tired of going down there. And, and really actually just really being hating is the word, hating on the fun of the St. Patrick's Day parade. When in essence, that's celebrating that moment in their history. We can celebrate our moment as well. And it could be a cross embracing of both.
It was like some residual just sadness at not having this other parade.
Right. And it just, I guess not a negative kind of hating, but just more so just, well, why can't we have our own, and it not understanding that you can't have your own, it just takes the time, commitment, dedication of people to really push the fold. Because, the parade was definitely not an easy feat. But then when we saw it come to fruition, we saw the participation of our parade entries, that's what really motivated us. And I think it motivated a lot of people because they really created some amazing floats.
Tell me more about the parade, both the one from, 20 years ago and the one that you've created. Are they similar, or did you kind of start from scratch and rebuild from the ground up?
We had to start from scratch. I never witnessed a parade. That was before my time when Dad was doing those, and I don't really remember those. I remember the street festivals, but so this committee actually had to go straight from complete scratch, Googling how do I plan a parade, and starting from that point and just kind of praying and learning as we go.
What are some of your favorite parts of the parade that you've created?
I like the drill teams were awesome we had this year. We have amazing horse riders. We have such an amazing horse community. I'm an avid horse lover. So he's seeing the horses doing the tricks in the street. We had one float with a group of young men that had built their float. Another boy who has a book club called Royal Boy Blue, and he had constructed his own float, got donations for his float. So it was just, and he actually recorded a song in the studio to play on his float as it proceeded down the parade procession. And it was awesome to see people dedicating their time, their money, their energy, and really doing it because they want to show pride in who they are.
On a personal level, when you took up the Juneteenth mantle, was that partly thinking about carrying on what your dad had started, or?
Yeah, the first one we did, it was a commemorative event. It had been 20 years since he had passed away. And there had just been a lot of change in the 18th and Vine District. And so that change in the district really kind of motivated me. And there was a lot of, I guess that's really too when a lot of the racial issues started to bubble. You know, we really weren't seeing a lot of the things going on, but you started kind of just feeling the tensions and things starting to rise. And I was speaking to some community members. One of our main supporters is Mr. Benny Shelby. He owns the Casey Juke House and a couple of businesses here, and has been, you know, a businessman here in Kansas City for about 50 years. We actually sat down and said, you know, we need to do that, bring this back. And he dedicated his time. He actually footed a lot of the cost of helping it happen for the last 2 to 3 years. We lost a lot, but we learned a lot as well. But, you know, really said that, you know, the community needs this. This is something that, you know, brings us back together. It's important. And you
felt needed it particularly in this moment where racial tension was starting to at least more visibly simmer again.
That and just to redefine our identity or our understanding what our identity is, because we understand that a lot of kids or a lot of youth nowadays don't understand what Juneteenth is. I mean, really, a lot of the motivating factor at this point is because we are starting, a lot of our elders are starting to pass, and now there is a generation shift. And the kids now need to understand that slavery was not that long ago. You know, our rights were not given to us that long ago. I mean, even our right to vote is not really is not in stone. I mean, Congress can go tomorrow and say, hey, we want to repeal that amendment, and our right to vote can be gone. So we have to stay focused. We have to stay part of and we have to stay relevant and part of and it is on them now to take, you know, to take the torch and pass it on. But it is to our responsibility to make sure that we give them the information, that we're telling the story. And a lot of our kids nowadays, they don't know what Juneteenth is. They think it's a festival. So a lot of it is re-education and letting them know that, no, it is way more. And unfortunately, like you said, too, unfortunately, Kansas City is, you know, we're really behind the times, because in D.C., Texas, you know, and major states, even in the Bahamas and even in some of the islands, they are celebrating Juneteenth. And it is a huge holiday.
Do you think that just right now, earlier when you spoke about the significance of Juneteenth, you spoke about the progress of African-Americans and the just the greater equality that people experience, that slavery is no more. I think that right now there's so much talk about what progress hasn't been made. And that's so much of what I hear when I interview people on this station. I wonder do you find people challenging you about this idea of progress and celebrating it?
I think sometimes... I have to be careful with this one. I think sometimes we are overanalyzed, or some people think that we have to ask permission, that the people don't understand that as citizens of this country, the system was in essence sometimes built to be citizen friendly, that if you want to defend yourself in law, or if you want to do something, if you research and find the way to do it, you have the full capability of doing it. And I guess the example I give is people used to ask me, or I've had people over the couple of years ask, well, who said you could do Juneteenth? I'm like, what do you mean? Who said we could do Juneteenth? No one has to tell you or give you permission to take action or to do anything. You know, if you do it the right way, you research, you make sure you have your little ducks in a row.
You Google how to make a parade.
I Googled how to start a festival. Google, and then also call, when you Google, then have some people that are authoritative, though. Verify your Google. But, you know, it really is there. I mean, America is a country where and it was built on the fact that we can come here and build something on your own. And, you know, my father's story is a little bit more painful because of the way he did leave this earth. And it did cause a lot of shifts because it was very much unplanned. No one, I mean, it came out of nowhere, his demise. So it really did cause a lot of shifts. And unfortunately, you know, I cannot dwell on that. We have to move on. And, you know, sometimes the moving on is the hardest part, but we can be empowered by some pain sometimes. Pain can empower us, and pain can push us to move forward and do some amazing things.
I have to assume that Juneteenth, as this huge accomplishment for you, you know, you have planned this thing, and it's coming to fruition. It started last weekend. It'll be the big event this weekend. Is it a time when you really remember your dad?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of it's weird because it falls right the day before Father's Day. And I've had some really crummy Juneteenth, so it's been kind of like a big emotional hit because it's just like, oh my gosh, it's Father's Day and it's horrible. One day we got rained out. It was horrible. But, you know, it is definitely for me because I, you know, I'm a volunteer. I don't get paid. I have a full-time job that, you know, I'm blessed that understands my commitment to Juneteenth. But, you know, it really is a labor of love and it's something that I want to do for him.
Makeda Peterson, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
This year's Juneteenth celebration will be at 18th and Vine at noon this Saturday. I'm Gina Kaufman, and in just a minute, we're going to hear a musician's story on KCUR's Central Standard after this break. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard, and this is a song called Unworthy by Kansas City's Stephon Singleton. Text too much cause you don't text me back. Do I say enough? Do I care too much? Am I out of luck? You never miss me much. I love it. Stephon is hitting his stride here in Kansas City, and it sounds to us like he could make it bigger than that any day, so we're dedicating the rest of today's show to hearing his story. Hi, Stephon.
Hello.
Tell me about this song.
So being black is hard, and being gay and black is really, really tough. I went to Catholic school my entire life, and so I wasn't really able to explore or experience love or flirting or the gay community until way later in my life. And so being a late bloomer in that respect, there was a lot of insecurity and there was a lot of feelings of unworthiness. And I fell for a lot of different guys, which is the story of my life, and it didn't work out. You know, just not fitting that stereotypical white, ripped, queer as folk kind of just image, I think, that people have in their minds of falling in love with. I just met a lot of adversity, you know, and I still meet that, you know.
The opening line is too much of this, too much of that.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Because sometimes you feel like you are too much of this or too much of that. Maybe I'm calling too much. Maybe I'm texting too much. Maybe I didn't text the right thing at this time. Or maybe, you know, maybe I'm completely delusional and this person doesn't even like me. I'm someone that's self-aware and very analytical. And I kind of definitely go there.
You grew up in Kansas City, Kansas. Tell me about your childhood and yeah, the family that raised you.
Well, I grew up in Wyandotte County, which is the poorest county in Kansas. And so I grew up in a relatively poor neighborhood. My parents always provided, my grandparents always provided and made sure that we were taken care of. But I saw a lot of examples of people maybe not reaching the dreams that they really wanted to reach. And my mom was always very supportive, is still very supportive, my grandparents. And they always pushed me to really be everything that I possibly could be and more and kind of strive beyond that. So I really had these great examples, these really strong examples of these women who persevered no matter what. And
women in particular?
Women in particular, yeah. My dad, God rest his soul, wasn't really around. I don't think he really knew how to be a dad at that time. And so I spent a lot of time with my grandmother and my mom and hearing their wisdom and hearing their struggles and listening to a lot of Mary J. Blige in my mom's car and a lot of strong females. And that really kind of captivated me and still captivates me and really helped me kind of push forward and never give up on my dream.
How did you start singing? You've got such a distinctive voice. People compare your voice to Prince or to Billie Holiday, very different frames of reference. But I hear that, but you've got your own thing going on.
Yeah, I was just like a little kid. I think we were like close to the front row, and this choir director at my church, Blessed Sacrament, Pat Fernandez, she heard me sing, and she had this solo in Jacob's Ladder and invited me up, and I had no fear at like 6 or 7, so I just got up and wailed out this solo. And I joined this choir of probably 30-plus year-olds, and I was in it throughout high school, and so I learned about, you know, vocal parts and solos and singing, and that was kind of my first introduction, really.
So you got into music at church. Had you been already exposed to a ton of music outside of church, or was the listening to Mary J. Blige yet to come?
Oh, no, absolutely. No, music was a part of everyday life. My mom would start cooking, she would light some incense, and she would turn on music. So it was Mary J. Blige, but it was also R. Kelly. It was the Isley Brothers. It was Luther Vandross. It was Patti LaBelle. It was Phyllis Hyman, Michelet, D'Angelo, Jill Scott. We had Barbra Streisand records. We had Billie Holiday. We had Prince. So whether it was in the car, whether it was at home, whether it was a vinyl, a cassette, we always had music.
And you started recording music in high school. That's pretty early. Tell me what that was like.
It was amazing. I knew from a very early age what I wanted. And what I wanted was to touch the most people possible with music. Music was this magical thing for me, and it still is this magical thing. And so reading liner notes, you know, when I'm like 10 years old, which no one does, and, you know, looking up producers and wanting to understand that world and be in that world, and seeing those music videos on MTV, you know, seeing Kurt Cobain, you know, seeing Smells Like Teen Spirit on TV just like really captured me and captivated me. So the first thing I wanted to do was get into the studio as soon as I possibly could. So I would borrow money from my grandma, and I would go to these late night sessions at Chapman Recording when it was still downtown. And my mom would drop me off and pick me up, and I would keep on going year after year and just recording things.
You crowdfunded a 2015 album called Caged Bird Sings Songs About Redbeard. And that, those references that you're making, like the Caged Bird Sings, can you talk to me about how you identify with, I don't know, like Maya Angelou or something like that?
Well, I remember reading that book in high school, and it really, the raw honesty of it, and also her very graphic experiences really inspired me. I think even reading stuff like The Scarlet Letter and all of those really like literary, super descriptive narratives influenced me as a songwriter. And also, I really love long titles. And so when that Fiona Apple album came out, When the Pond Hits, and it's like this big long poem, I was really inspired by that. And being a caged bird for me is something that I've kind of felt like my whole life. I'm more of an introverted person. Like I said, I was a late bloomer. And so in Falling in Love, and kind of the thing that started the writing of this album, this guy to me really just wanted my heart for my heart's sake and wanted my attention for my attention's sake. He wasn't really concerned about me or that reciprocation. And so being a caged bird, if the cage is open, you can fly away at any time, right? But I chose to stay within that cage, and I chose to sing about this guy. And also there's nautical references, like I think a pirate just takes to take, right? And so I think that is a lot of what that title represents, but it represents, you know, so much more. That's the beautiful thing about art. You can kind of take what you want from it.
Right now, you've got a new song that you're going to release this Friday, and I want to listen to a little bit of it and talk to you about it. It's called Hide and Seek. Should we listen?
Let's do it.
So talk to me about your creative process.
My creative process is just rolling around in life. And then one day I'll wake up, and if I feel a melody, if I feel lyrics, I'll grab my notepad and my pen and I'll just start writing. Most of it's in my head. I went to college for music, so I can notate things. So sometimes I'll sit at a piano, and that's where some of these songs came from. But generally for me, it's always lyrics and melody first, always.
Talk to me about the production aspect of it. This is a really tightly produced sound.
Yeah, Jamie Cyril is probably like the greatest person on the planet. He's my best friend, but he is, to me, a musical genius. He is a musical genius arranger, producer. And he was the first person that I met that kind of got my vision, that really understood this song. I played a few chords on the piano for him at my first meeting with him and my friend Andrew Twinter. And he just went right in on his guitar and knew exactly how the song sounded. And the next thing I know, that week we're in the studio with trumpets and strings and all of these different things. And he orchestrated it all. So he just, it was kind of kismet, you know, meeting him and understanding that vision, you know, together.
You know, that brings me to, Jamie is involved with my brothers and sisters, the band that you are performing with this Friday at the Record Bar. Tell me about that show.
It's going to be a really, really amazing, killer show. I feel like we've really leveled up. There's some really incredible visual elements that we've never really been able to do until now.
Are you willing to divulge what they might be?
There's just some really brilliant stuff with lights and costuming. And there's something so powerful about being backed by a nine-piece band. Like, I feel like the king of the world every time it happens. Like, this light switch pops on and I am someone else.
Who is that other person?
He is Stefan in his fullness, I think. I think the stage allows me to be vulnerable and be strong and be sexual and be sensual and be angry and be every single thing that I am. I can't even describe it. It's the most incredible thing. And to be affiliated with Jamie and have him with his 12-piece band go on right after my set is a pleasure. And everyone is just, it's just so connected. It feels like we're all a family, even though we're two separate entities, right? We definitely vibe off of each other and vibe off of this really special thing I think that Jamie has found and that I've found throughout my entire life.
What is the role of emotion in music for you?
It's everything. It's the conductor for me. I think feelings are kind of the king of me. So I had to really feel something if I'm going to write it, and I had to really feel it if I'm going to sing it. So
tell us one last, can you give us one last little tease about what's going to happen in Friday Night Show? Just any more little detail?
Well, you know, I'm gonna deliver like I've never delivered before. It's a full set. It's the Record Bar stage, which is a dream come true. Doors at 9:30, show at 10. And I have these new leather pants I'm really excited to wear.
Yes, that's the kind of detail I was looking for.
I knew
if I just kept waiting.
I think my hair might be silver. There's feathers. I'm pumped.
There we go. Well, Stefan Singleton, it's been great getting to know you today.
Great getting to talk to you. Thank you.
You can listen back to today's show at kcur.org/Central Standard later today. We talked to Stefan. We also talked to Makita Peterson about the 18th and Vine Juneteenth celebration, and with Nathan Darrow about the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival. The show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Danielle Hogarty is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next, so don't miss it.